And tonight is another wonderful question and answer night. And I was no sooner finished last time than I got an email. I think they were typing during the service on their cell phone. And they said, you solved that lying is not okay even for Pharaoh's midwives or for Rahab the harlot, but you did not answer why God blessed them so much. And I thought, well, that question will never end. So that's the first one, something along, why did God bless Rahab so much? Or in the bulletin, why did God bless the midwives of Egypt and Rahab even though they lied? That's the first one. Then the second one is an anonymous one from someone that is afraid to go to the microphone. Right? No. You weren't supposed to answer. No one knew who I was looking at. And it's just a simple one. So I'll start out with those two, and then there'll be time for others, I'm sure. But thank you, Phil. The first one is, I forget who even asked this in the beginning, but Karen is the one that asked the follow-up. And the follow-up was, why did God bless, especially Rahab? It doesn't really, I mean, it says that he blessed the houses of the midwives. But Rahab is very large in the scriptures. I don't know if you've thought about it. Why did God bless Rahab so much is the question. And despite her lying. So that's the one we'll do first. The second one is, before I forget, the anonymous person asked, the millennium versus the new heavens and new earth. What's the difference? And one word is the difference, but I'll elaborate on it, and it's this. Sin is still present here. It's just subdued. It's just suppressed by God, held back. But it's still percolating until almost everyone rebels against God. Even though it appears biblically that the millennium is populated by only believers. And we'll go through that in Matthew 25 and Revelation 20. So that was the anonymous question. But let's do this. Why did God bless Rahab so much? And we already have covered that she deceived at the least and lied flatly for the two spies. So we don't need to go back to Joshua 2 and look at that. But I think that some of us don't think about the blessing part. And I think this is, I'm glad that Karen asked this question. So let me just do this. Rahab is the only Gentile that shows up in Hebrews 11. Isn't that fascinating? And few women, and she's one of the few, that is all talked about their faith. She becomes a portrait, Rahab does, of faith. She portrays for us, I think, and it will be why I want to talk about this. I'm glad that it was asked. How did people get saved back there anyway? And how does God deal with their knowledge of the law and their not knowing about the law? In fact, when Paul went out and preached to pagans, he says they never got the special revelation of God, so God treats them in a different way. Have you ever thought about that? That God treats people differently depending on how much they know. Also, down here in this one, Galatians 2:16 is the classic verse on salvation. So let's look at Rahab and see what's going on with her life in Hebrews 11. Let's go there first. Because the first thing about Rahab is that God does not downplay the lying. He saved a sinner. And what is truly remarkable about Rahab is that Rahab was equal to the worst of all the sinners of Jericho. She was a woman that was what we would say quintessentially Canaanite. She was a prostitute. And the one common denominator of Canaanites were that they were sexually perverse. That's why God said in Genesis 15 that he wanted them exterminated. They were a blight to society because they were so perverted. I told you last time, they murdered infants as just one of their perversions. But look what God points out about her. It's in Hebrews 11, starting in verse 30. And it's only the only coverage of her is two verses there. It says, by faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they were encircled for 7 days. So that sets the context. We're in Joshua. By faith, the harlot, Rahab. Isn't that interesting? We know about doubting Thomas. We know about denying Peter. And we know Rahab was a harlot. Isn't it interesting that the Bible is so vivid about the reality that we're all sinners, but God only saves sinners? She was a harlot. She was equal to the worst of all of the people that were. God didn't spare a single Jericho inhabitant except Rahab and her family. That should just jump off the page. But look at this. By faith, the harlot Rahab, so she was definitely a sinner, lying was probably very low on the list of her big sins. I mean, she had much bigger ones. And she's just a liar because everybody lied probably in that culture that had very little moral law of God involved in it. But by faith, the harlot Rahab did not perish with those who did not believe, when she had received the spies with peace. So what it says is that she was a woman of faith, and the faith was demonstrated by receiving the spies. Okay, so that's all that that Hebrews tells us. Now let's go to James, the next book. And what's interesting is that this comes up in James chapter 2. It's just two pages away for me in my Bible. And let me find it. Come on, where's Rahab? Let's see. What is it? Oh, it's in chapter 1. I was looking in chapter 2. It's in chapter 1? No. Oh, 2:25. Here we go. Thanks. Likewise, good, it's James 2:25. You know why it's so hard to find verses? When I was in college, they used to always say the boys took too long showers and were using up all the hot water in the dorm. And so we were limited to less than 5 minutes for our showers. And I found out that you could say the entire book of James in the shower in less than 5 minutes. So I didn't have to wear my watch in there and get it wet. And I would just say the whole book as fast as I could and know that at the end, the 5 minutes. But it all runs together now because I did it so fast when I used to say it. But look at 2:25, and it says, likewise, was not Rahab, look at that tag, the harlot, also justified by works when she, and look at this, it's the same event, when she received the messengers, and James adds, and sent them out another way. So what it says is that she was a sinner that was justified. And the evidence of her justification was that she received the spies and sent them out. Now, think about what this meant. She, Rahab, by faith, the Bible tells us, so we wouldn't have known that if it wasn't God told us, but by faith, she, first of all, staked her future on the God of Israel, on the true and living God of Israel. Remember, she was a Canaanite. She was a pagan. She was, as the Hebrew word cherem. She was destined for total destruction. She staked her future on the God of Israel, and she risked, I mean, here the conquerors were outside the wall. Their spies came in to scope out the city. She harbored, aided, and abetted. What would we do in any war with anyone that aided the enemy that was one of us? We would call them a traitor, and that would be treason, and most likely they would be executed. So she risked her life for the God of Israel. And she had faith in the God of Israel. So what we see is a guilty sinner who operates as a sinner. She's a prostitute and a liar, probably a whole bunch of other sins. And God does not say, I blessed her because she is a liar. Did you know that we're all liars in this room? Even if you don't lie, you're a liar. Because we're of our father, the devil, and we were born fallen. And we, just like we carry tons of other pathogens on our body that right now are not infecting us, but they're always there, spiritually we're all to the core desperately wicked. She was desperately wicked, but she did something that was an amazing demonstration of faith. By the way, now this is not rhetorical. This is a audible answer, okay? Did God need Rahab to lie to accomplish his will? No. Because what does Proverbs, I mean, here, I didn't even say this last time. What does Proverbs 12, I think it's 22 say? I'm going to look it up real quick. Because remember, God is immutable. Let me find this. 12, maybe it's not 22, but yes. Look at this. Proverbs 12:22. It says, lying lips are an abomination to the Lord. Solomon wrote that 3,000 years ago. God doesn't change. It doesn't mean that 3,000 years ago, all of a sudden, God says lying is abominable. God, from eternity past, is changelessly truth. God is truth. So God always believes any lying is always an abomination. Even little white lies are big, bad, black, filthy, wretched of our father, the devil lies. I think most of us have very tame views of truth compared to God's standard. Rahab did something abominable in God's sight. And it says in the book of Revelation that all liars have their place in the lake of fire. So she was a guilty, rotten, lying, fornicatious, adulterous, probably, because some of those men she was with were probably married, harlot. And God saved her. For lying? No. That's not what the record says. For receiving. Did you catch what God said she did? Her faith was demonstrated not by lying about it. She didn't have to lie about it. God could have transported them out of there. God could have made them like Jesus, invisible in the temple, so that the people coming to arrest him couldn't find him. God could have done anything to them. He could have smitten all of them with blindness, like the homosexuals trying to get Lot's or trying to get the angels visiting Lot, that they couldn't see and even find the door. God does not need us to lie to perform his will. And that's the bottom line. We should not try and find proof text to excuse our behavior. God doesn't need us to lie to do his perfect will. We choose to lie. It's kind of like this morning I told you that we carry our cares through life because we're not sure God could handle them. We can't trust him to him. We're going to do it. We think we've got to lie to do God's will. But why did God save her? If she was justified, what was she justified for? Well, let's go in reverse order. Go to Galatians 2, because this is a great one. to Galatians. That's the chief book on whether or not law-keeping gets us to heaven. In fact, in one of the small groups that I meet, I got a text, and it said, we're studying the Ten Commandments, you know, Tuesday morning at 6:15. We're looking forward to understanding, you know, whether keeping the Ten Commandments is vital for our salvation. Well, here's the answer. Galatians 2:16, knowing that a man is not justified by works of the law, but by faith in Jesus Christ. Even we have believed in Christ Jesus, that we might be justified by faith in Christ and not by works of the law. For by the works of the law, by law keeping, by keeping all the Ten Commandments with as hard and as fastidiously as we can, like the Apostle Paul tried to do and almost was able to do, no works of the law will justify us. She was only justified, this harlotress liar, by faith. The faith was demonstrated because she did something that was really an act of faith. She identified not with the Canaanite deities, but with the true and living God, and she risked everything to side with him. Remember what Jesus said, you can't be my disciple unless you are willing to give up all and follow me? She was willing to give up her life to follow him. And how much of the Bible did she have? None. None. I mean, it was only at that point written down and kept in the tabernacle inside the ark. There were, Zondervan had not been invented yet, you know, and et cetera, the internet. She had nothing but these two things. And this is what's so interesting. And this, I mean, there's a lot of directions we could go, but the reason God blessed her was the same reason he blesses us. All of us are guilty, lying, adulterous. We're all sinners, murderers at heart, adulterers at heart, liars at heart, thieves at heart. And we are all saved the same way. Justified by faith, not by keeping works. But look at Romans 2:12. We'll back into this. Romans 2:12. For as many as have sinned without the law. So everybody, like Rahab, that never heard the moral law of God written down in special revelation. Special revelation. And that's what Paul was going to, and I'll show you what he says in Acts 14. But for as many as have sinned without law will also perish without law. And as many as have sinned in the law will be judged by the law. For not the hearers of the law are just in the sight of God, but the doers of the law will be justified. For when Gentiles who do not have the law by nature do things in the law, these, though they do not have the law, are a law to themselves, who show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience, verse 15, bearing witness in between themselves, their thoughts excusing. So what he's talking about is there is, in Romans 2:12, there is a special revelation. Special revelation equals the Bible, the written, revealed law of God. There is special revelation, and if they don't have that, there's something else. And that's what gets us to Romans 1:18. And that's our conscience, the internal witness of God, our conscience, and creation. That's the voice of God that can be heard throughout, you know, the heavens declaring the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. And everyone has those. So back up from 1 to 1:18, and it says, for the wrath of God, Romans 1:18, is revealed against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. And Rahab was ungodly. Because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen and being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal Godhead, and they are without excuse. And so what it says is that creation, that's this passage, and conscience in 2:18, or however far I read, 2:12 to 20, talks about conscience, that the moral laws written on our conscience by God. They don't have the Bible. They have their conscience. And Rahab had her conscience, but it's just probably she had lied so much, you know. People would call her harlotry place and say, is my husband there? She'd say, no, your husband's not there. And she'd say, go home quick. Your wife's calling. She had just gotten used to lying. And that was just part of her trade. But she wasn't saved for lying. She was saved because she believed the God of Israel so much that she received his representatives. And her conscience caused her to stake her future and risk her life to serve the God who she knew she was a sinner against, because her conscience was revealing that to her. So one more thing I want to take you back to. Come on. There. Let's go to Acts 14, because I want to show you how Paul approached this when he preached, because he was always preaching in places where the gospel had never been preached and where they had no copy of the Word of God. And a lot of times we're always concerned about the Aborigines and the Pygmies and the Eskimos and the Native Americans who never had missionaries come to them. Well, it's interesting. Paul went to people, but he was the first missionary to come to them. And what he says is, when he's preaching at Iconium and Lystra, in chapter 14 and verse 16 and 17, it's interesting what he says. Who in bygone generations... Well, I'll back up. Verse 15, saying, men, what are you doing these things? We also are men of the same nature, and preach to you that you should turn from these useless things to the living God, who made the heavens and the earth, the sea, and all things that are in them. Isn't it interesting? That's the 11th time the gospel is presented in the book of Acts. And how is it presented? Believe in the Creator. And yet we have a whole segment of Christianity, that does not believe that God made the heaven, the earth, the sea, and everything in them. They don't believe God made those things. They don't believe in fiat creation, that God spoke it into existence. They believe in evolutionary accommodation. And the gospel presented here and at the very end in Revelation 14 always says that salvation comes when you believe who the true Creator is. Very significant, because we have a whole generation of Christians that don't believe in creation, which is an oxymoron. Christians that aren't believing in creation, which is amazing. So he says that. Now look at verse 16. Who in bygone days, the Creator, in bygone generations, allowed all nations to walk in their own ways. What on earth does that mean? That's where we get universalism from. They pick it out. They say, oh, God isn't going to... No one in the past that didn't hear the gospel is going to have to face his judgment. No, it doesn't say that. It says that God did not hold them to the special revelation, to all the Mosaic laws, to all the revelation of the character of God that's revealed in the law of God that talks about his changeless character. God does not hold them. God does not hold the people who never got the special revelation to the revelation that they never got. He judges them by those candles he gave them of their conscience, where it said already in chapter 2 that they have the moral law of God written on their heart. Everyone does that has a conscience. Everyone that has a mind, that's born with a functioning mind. That's why God, when he's destroying Nineveh, said, wait a minute, Jonah, doesn't it bother you that there are 120,000 little people in that town that don't even know? They're not even old enough to know their right hand from their left hand. They don't really yet have not gotten to the point. That's where we get this age of accountability thing, if you ever heard that. It comes back to God differentiating between fully conscious, functioning people and those who are developing and don't fully understand everything yet. But look at verse 16. who in generations allowed all nations to walk in their own ways. Nevertheless, he did not leave himself without witness that he did good and gave us rain from heaven and fruit and seasons filling our heart with food and gladness. And with these sayings, he scarcely restrained them. So what is he talking about? Well, he picks up the same thing. Keep going to chapter 17, because he's got another group that haven't had the gospel brought to them before. He does the same thing again in chapter 17, verse 24. He shares a creation-based gospel with pagans, with people that are unchurched and unmissionary and ungospel. And he says, God, who made the world and everything in it. That's an even more strict, literal creationist message. Since he is Lord of heaven and earth, doesn't dwell in temples, and verse 25 isn't worshipped with men's hands. Since he gives to all life, breath, and all things, verse 26, he made from one blood every nation, in other words, directly created humanity, so they should seek and find him. But look at this in verse 30. Truly, these times of ignorance God overlooked. What does that mean? That nobody before Acts 17 is going to be judged for their sins? No. They will not be held to the standard that every one of us sitting here today and everybody basically around this world, we have unlimited access to the truth of God. We just don't take advantage of it as much as we should. But we have the special revelation, the written word of God that's just permeating. It's in thousands of languages and it's in trillions of cache files in the internet all over the place. But what he says is in verse 30, these times of ignorance God overlooked, but now commands all men everywhere to repent because he's appointed a day. And when they heard of the resurrection, verse 33, they mocked. So, basically, before I wander too far away, Karen says, why did God bless Rahab so much? Same reason he blessed all of us in this room. Because Rahab was a guilty sinner equal to the worst of Jericho, did not deserve to be saved. But she reached out in faith to the God who had revealed himself to her that she had heard about, and she responded to him in faith. And the faith prompted her to receive what James 2:25 says. She was justified by the response of her faith, receiving those spies, which caused her to stake her future by faith on the God of Israel. She is remarkable that she knew so much or so little and believed God so much that she staked everything and risked her life even though she was a guilty liar. So Karen is not here tonight, and I went through all of this for her, so someone tell her I answered it. Okay. And Tom is here tonight even though he's anonymous, and let's do this, because in Matthew 25, we have the sheep and goat judgment, and the millennium starts. So let's go to Matthew 25, and it says in verse 31, the Son of Man comes in his glory, and all the holy angels with him. We've already covered that. That's the second coming. And then he says to those on his right, here we go, verse 33, he will set the sheep on his right hand and the goats on his left, and the king will say to those on his right, the sheep. Those who believe in him. Sheep and goat judgment is between those who believe and those who don't. And God separates everybody on earth, everybody that survives the tribulation. So basically, the millennium, you have the tribulation period, and at the end of the tribulation, the second coming of Christ, and then after that, you have the sheep and goat judgment, this judgment, this separation that you see in Matthew 25. And so everybody that survives the tribulation goes into this, and they go into two groupings, sheep and goats. And how do we know who's who? Well, I mean, what does the Lord say about them? And the king will say in verse 34 to those in his right hand, I should have switched those, so he's up here looking down there on his right hand, The king will say to those, come, you blessed of my father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. I was hungry, you gave me drink, all that. And then he will say in verse 41, to those on his left hand, depart from me, you cursed, into everlasting fire, prepared for the devil and his angels. So the sheep go into the millennium, the kingdom, and the goats head to the waiting room for hell, because no one's in hell yet. So this is tribulation. This is Revelation 6 through 18. Second coming, Revelation 19. Sheep and goat judgment, Matthew 25. Millennium, Revelation 20. So the question was, what's the difference between the millennium and the new heavens? Right here. Watch what happens in Revelation 20. And we've looked at this many times, but it's staggering just to look at it for this reason. The staggering power of sin. And last time, what someone asked was kind of what the millennium was like. And I told them that God sets up a visitor center. This is a millennium. Millennium. It's 1,000 years. That's repeated. Notice what it says in chapter 20, verse 2, 1,000 years. Verse 3, 1,000 years. Verse 4 at the end, 1,000 years. Verse 5, 1,000 years. Verse 6, 1,000 years. And verse 7, 1,000 years. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times it says 1,000 years. So it's 1,000 years. God said so 6 times. And mille means 1,000. And so that millennium is not in the Bible. 1,000 years. It's into the kingdom. It's into this 1,000-year millennial rule, the 1,000-year rule of Christ. And so they go into it. And the 1,000 years goes on. And verse 2, Satan is suppressed. So Satan is locked up. He's locked down, actually, in the pit. He is on lockdown. Now, remember, we saw this morning in 1 John 5:19 that all of the world's system is being governed in its malignancy by Satan. He is pervading, influencing, and energizing all the and magnifying all the sin that we're born with, and he's just inflaming it and going on. All of the world, he is the God of this world. Everything we looked at this morning. So the commander-in-chief gets locked down. That's in chapter 20, verse 2. And he's in the bottomless pit for that whole time. The abusas, the place of being separated and under incarceration. Now look at verse 7. When the 1,000 years have expired, Satan is released from his prison. And look at verse 8, Revelation 28. This is the difference between new heavens and new earth and the millennium. Everyone can still be deceived. In other words, the people alive under their fig trees and by their vines in this nearly perfect kind of like garden, I mean, it's what everybody wants to go on vacation to, where there's no poisonous anything. It's kind of like Kauai, you know, where they don't have any poisonous snakes and everything. It's just such a special place, you know, and it rains all the time and everything grows big and there's fruit and fish and clean water and it smells nice and everything. They're in this kind of Hawaiian island paradise, but sin is still there, just waiting. And so what happens, Satan is released, verse 7. He deceives the nations which are in the four corners, verse 8 of Revelation 20. And they go out the breadth of the earth, verse 9. So everyone except the people camping with God. You know what it comes down to? What it's always come down to. Few there be that find it. Few there be that Jesus said, the straight and narrow is the way, and few there be that find the way. And it's only when God reaches down to Rahab's, reaches down and knocks Paul's off their horses, reaches down and scares the people of Nineveh to death so they repent. It's only when God directly intervenes that people come to him. The miracle is not the miracle is not that we're saved. The miracle is that anyone is saved. We're all desperately wicked. It's only when God initiates. Anything God does not hold gets worse. He didn't hold Satan, he got worse. Fell away. Started this whole mess. We have to be kept by the power of God through faith unto salvation. So God isn't holding, he's just holding back the malignity of sin. But as soon as he lets Satan out, and that's why we need to be praying to be delivered. God holds back sin, suppresses it, until Satan is let out, and Satan ramps it up. And he ramps it up so big that, verse 9, they went up the breadth of the earth, they surrounded the camp of the saints in the beloved city, and God says, enough is enough. That's it. And fire, verse 9, comes down from God out of heaven. So, another difference between the millennium, which is totally on earth, and heaven is, so number two, the first one is sin, Tom. The second one is the merging, the new heavens and new earth, of heaven and earth, the merging of heaven and earth, which is Revelation 21. So in 20, we see that the characteristic of the millennium is that sin is still present. But in Revelation 21, now keep looking after God burns them all up in the great white throne, and I saw a new heaven and a new earth. So Revelation 21 doesn't explain what 2 Peter 3 says. 2 Peter 3 says that God, just like he flooded the whole earth with water with Noah, God burns up the entire universe with fire. The first time he destroyed the whole earth alone, not the universe, just the earth with water. But 2 Peter 3 says that God dissolves everything, heavens and earth. He dissolves and reconstitutes. Now, not heaven, his throne, and all the angels in the crystal sea. The physical world. The physical world permeated with sin and the spiritual world fallen and following the devil. All of that, in fact, Romans 8 says that it's not just earth. Romans 8 says that the whole universe groans. The universe, the largest supernova ever seen that they just detected, and the new, did you hear about Einstein's waves of gravity, and all that universe is groaning because sin has permeated it. But what happens is there's a new heavens in Revelation 21 and a new earth, and I, John, verse 2, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven. And the New Jerusalem is this cube that is gigantic. It says that it's laid out in a square in verse 16 of 21, 12,000 furlongs. And so it's this gigantic, if you looked at the new heaven and new earth, here's earth and this 1,200 furlong cube is the new Jerusalem. You know, we always sing, I saw the new Jerusalem. You cannot put on an 8,000-mile in diameter earth a 1,200-furlong cube and have it spinning at 1,000 miles an hour under current laws of physics. But who invented physics? Newton only discovered elements of it. Einstein discovered some, too. But the inventor is going to reconstitute the universe so he can put this New Jerusalem cube right on the earth. And so the difference is only two. In the new heavens and new earth, which was the question, everything is new. Everything is new as far as sin. Heavens. Sin is gone, so no sin. and earth and heaven, the New Jerusalem, are merged. You say, what does that mean? I don't know. Because we're, during the millennium, where are we? We're with the Lord. But the apostles, at least, and others are going to reign on the earth. And so there's, before they're merged, the heavenly city is there. It's still a cube. And they're going like this. There seems to be, we're going back and forth, kind of like the angels came and went and disappeared, and Jesus would disappear and come back. But then God merges them, and that's where we get into everything that Tom didn't ask about in 21 and 22. So it's 6:59. So, Les, I'm sorry you put up the microphones, but we have to send off the team. So what I thought I'd do is, if anybody couldn't sleep tonight without your question, lest you email me during the service, why don't you come up and ask it, and I'll write it down, and then we're going to send off the team. So do we have any takers? And I'll write it down, because you were so patient tonight. So any questions? Dory, is that you? Your last question was 20 minutes long.
This has to do with lying, too, but I've been thinking about this for a while. This is in 1 Kings 13, and it's about, okay, Jeroboam was a jerk for following false gods. So that's the northern kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
And, okay, death of the man of God. So it was some prophet that was sent to give a message, and the altar split in two, and he prophesied, I think Josiah was going to come, but that's in the future. But the old prophet, I guess the old prophet's sons came back and said, hey, Dad, there's this guy in town doing this stuff. And so the old prophet sent for him, but he was not supposed to eat or drink, and the king offered half his kingdom and everything, and the prophet said, no, I gotta, do what I'm told to do. But here's the part. I mean, I understand the point of the whole story. It's that you got to do exactly what God tells you to do. But I'm just taking a guess, but it says the old prophet and the other prophet. So my hunch is the prophet that came with the message was perhaps younger, mm-hmm. less experienced, maybe lacked insight to know that the guy was deceiving him.
That's really the issue. He didn't obey, and he got deceived.
But he went and ate and drank with the old prophet, and then the prophet prophesied to him that he was going to die. And then he was on his way home. He gets killed by the lion, and then the lion and the donkey are standing there. Then the old prophet goes out and gets him. And I guess it was an honor to be buried, like they buried him.
Yeah, but the lesson of that is God desires absolute obedience. And see, boy, if God desired from that Old Testament prophet that he totally do, because God says, don't eat or drink, don't do anything else, just deliver the message and go. And he listened to that old guy, was deceived by him, ate and drank with him, and God summarily executed him. Now, it doesn't mean he lost his salvation. It doesn't mean he was unsaved. It's the same thing as Ananias and Sapphira. And see, God summarily executed them for disobedience. So that's where we'll pick up. So frame
One other thing, though, with Ananias and Sapphira, for anyone who has ever told a lie or told a lie in a church house, shouldn't we all be dropping like flies?
Yeah, which is why that God's forbearance, that he does not execute
merciful
all of us.
Loving kindness.
Yeah.
Okay. That one's been, even before the lie questions came up, that's such a powerful scene that the lion and the donkey are standing there and the guy was dead on the road.
And God makes examples out of certain people.
And he doesn't give their names, which is probably merciful too.
Yeah, so when we bump into him in heaven, we won't say, are you the one that was eaten or almost eaten by the lion?
Yeah.
So, but what I like about you, Dory, is that you really read the Bible. I mean, the last time she dredged up the most amazing question I've ever found or heard someone say that I'm still thinking about.
Right, and also prophets It could have been a lifetime job or calling, or sometimes say it was a short, go do this. And he picked all kinds of different people to be prophets. Whereas priest, you got born into it. It was the tribe and that kind of thing. And he picked all kinds of different people to be prophets.
Yeah, the prophets, it was like came and went and the spirit came on them, but a priest was for his adult lifetime.
You got born into it, right?
Yeah, hereditary, yes.
Okay.
But the prophet was called.
But it was just, I've been thinking about this section, and then the talking about lies came up, and I just put it all together. But I feel kind of bad for the prophet. However, he got the severity of it. And the other guy, like the king, he got his hand restored and everything. And he was leading all the people into...
But think of this. The guy that was killed on the spot instantly went to paradise. Which is far better. Then, I mean, Abraham's bosom in the place of great joy and comfort compared to getting old and sick. And you understand, actually, is a blessing. Paul said to die is far better, but it's more needful for me to stay. We think of death as ruining everything and it's all going to be over and it won't be any fun. Jesus said, when you enter life, he called this not even life. Jesus said, what we're existing right now compared to where we're going, the joys, the true pleasure. He said, you're not even alive right now when you enter life. He it slipped out of him. If everybody knew how good heaven was, we would be wanting to go right now.
And also the fact that the lion and the donkey stood there and they didn't...
A supernatural, yeah.
Well, God's in charge of nature.
Mm-hmm. Which is what goes on in the millennium. So you tied it to the millennium. God can suppress the carnivorosity, or whatever you want to call it, of animals, and they don't attack if he suppresses it, just like he can suppress sin. Dory, thank you. You're a blessing.